this is Disorder, a show where we, you know, sometimes assess retaliatory cycles and their potential for escalation in our mad, 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 and seemingly quite revengeful world. I am very fortunate to be joined by our returning champion, Arthur Snell, who will be bringing us up to speed on this morning's developments over the skies of central Iran. Welcome, Arthur.
Hi, Jason. Great to be with you. So, yeah, you've mentioned what's been going on in Iran. So we're speaking on Friday. Overnight Thursday, there was definitely some kind of limited Israeli missile strike on Isfahan. Isfahan is an important city in Iran. It's associated with the Iranian military. It's associated also with facilities connected to the Iranian nuclear program. But I think it has to be said that, as far as we can see, these are very limited strikes. And to some extent, one wonders whether this was not an Israeli strike so much as a little sort of experimental kind of fact-finding mission. But certainly there were explosions. The Iranians are saying that there's been no serious damage or other impact. But we are in this situation of a sort of tit-for-tat situation between Israel and Iran.
And Isfahan is, of course, the historic capital of Iran with the beautiful mosques and the Safavid grandeur. And Isfahan itself was not hit, but some outer-lying military base was attacked, no casualties and anything like that. So I'm really concerned about, you know, how to prevent World War III amidst these retaliatory strikes, because they do lead to certain escalatory pressures. So who better to bring into this conversation than Jane Kinnamont? Her day job with the European Leadership Network involves working with security officials, diplomats all across Europe who share the interest in preventing nuclear war. Jane is a peace and security expert with two decades of experience covering the Middle East, both at the Economist Intelligence Unit and at Chatham House. Ahlan wa sahlan fil Disorder, Jane.
Ahlan bik.
Jane, so what was it like getting your kids ready for school or breakfast this morning?
I woke up, like many people, very alarmed to see headlines saying Israel attacks Iran. And as I delved more into the details of what has happened, although there's a lot at this point still to be confirmed, I think there are some things that can bring some relief. Most notably, it's not yet clear that this is much different from the earlier attacks that Israel has managed to carry out inside Iran, aimed at deterring and disrupting its nuclear program. Also important to note that the International Atomic Energy Agency quickly came out to say there were no damage to Iran's nuclear sites. It had said earlier in the week that it was suspending inspections because it was rather worried. So these things are relative positives, but they also illustrate that the violence and the confrontation between Israel and Iran has already got to quite dangerous levels for months or years now. Finally, though, there is global attention going into finding ways to de-escalate. So let's talk a bit more about how that could happen. Just on the kids going to school, I did have my daughter complaining, could I get off the phone to the BBC because I was making her late.
But what you didn't explain is, are limited missile strikes normal before breakfast in the Kinnamont household?
Well, unfortunately, you know, I'm watching all this stuff from a distance in a way where it can seem quite routine, it can seem quite normal, and we can step back and say, oh, this one wasn't so bad, this could get worse, not feeling the full anxiety of the millions of people who are on the front line thinking could get worse means it might get worse, maybe tomorrow.
Arthur, how are Iran's and Israel's Sunni Arab neighbors featuring in the current strategic calculus? What do we know about their reactions?
Well, I think in an interesting way, the degree of irrelevance strikes me. We've talked for years about Iran and Saudi Arabia being in a shadow war, and clearly Iran sort of sits at the top of the Shia Islam, and Saudi Arabia with the holy places of Mecca and Medina, it has a similar, not equal, but similar role perhaps in Sunni Islam. But in a way, since the unfolding of the sort of post-October 7th crisis, and particularly obviously the war in Gaza, we're reminded that Iran has this network of proxy groups which are very powerful and stretches from Yemen to Lebanon, to Iraq, Syria, and so on. Whereas actually the Gulf Arab countries are really, their might is basically economic. So in spite of the billions that have been spent by Gulf Arab countries over decades on military hardware, they don't really have the ability to sort of change the weather in a situation such as this. So even in the most recent case study of Iran's strike on Israel, and of course we're talking about Israel's possible strike on Iran, or certainly very limited strike on Iran overnight, but over the weekend you had Iran striking Israel in a much bigger fashion. We heard that the Jordanian Air Force had an involvement in sort of interdicting some of those incoming missiles, but I'm not aware that there was any significant role played by any of the Gulf Arab states. So yes, of course the Gulf Arab states are extremely important as allies, and particularly important economically, clearly Saudi Arabia with its role in global energy production. But actually, when it comes to hard strategic military power, I see them as surprisingly unimportant in this story.
That's really interesting. I have a slightly different view because we don't know the role that Saudi or Jordanian intelligence, as well as use of their airspace, provided Israel in shooting down the barrage of drones and missiles. My view is that it might actually have been quite critical, but I'm just postulating. However, you've hit on something that is key. Netanyahu and many of the generals around him, maybe even quote-unquote moderates like Benny Gantz, believe in Israel's right to go it alone, and that Israel is strong if it, you know, portrays strength and does its own thing. And I think that's a very antiquated version of strength. But the Israelis have not necessarily leveraged connections that they could be having, you know, with the Saudis and Emiratis for sure. And maybe if they had been offering the Qataris more, they could have gotten their hostages back, or they can, you know, they could propose interesting and novel diplomatic initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, I think on that point, one thing we do know, because it, you know, it's come out in a lot of reporting, is that prior to the October the 7th attacks, Egyptian intelligence, perhaps unsurprisingly, seemed to know quite a lot about Hamas's intentions. And Egypt has a long history of not of supporting or helping Hamas, but being very kind of very well informed about their actions and intentions. And it seems that Israel ignored or certainly didn't take particularly seriously those warnings. And of course, what we have a situation where there are Arab countries in formal alliance with Israel, and Egypt and Jordan in particular have been for many years. And there are definitely in interrelations between the intelligence agencies kept very quiet because, of course, they're very controversial. But it's possible that the sort of very nationalist turn that Israel has taken, particularly under Netanyahu, has rendered some of those connections largely sort of unproductive.
I agree. I analyze it similarly. We don't know exactly what's happening behind the scenes, but clearly Israel is not making the most of ways in which its Sunni Arab allies might actually want to protect Israeli security because they want order in the world. And what we saw, to my mind, last weekend, and I'm talking about the Saturday night, Sunday morning strikes from Iran on Israel, is that there really is an axis of orderers. What David Patrick Carrico said on this podcast, the status quo anti-coalition, the October 6 coalition, where the Sunni Gulf states plus Jordan and Egypt really do want stability, and they don't want this getting out of control. So it seems like, in addition to the Sunni Arab states that don't want this getting out of control, Iran and Israel may also not want this to escalate too much. So Jane, did they just want to like show off their capabilities and reassert deterrence, but without letting this getting out of control? How is that working?
Let me frame this in terms of order, because while I agree with you that the Arab states of the region want stability, I don't think they thought they had stability to begin with. And I think the idea of international order doesn't resonate with that many people in the Middle East, because the region hasn't been experiencing order. It's been experiencing huge amounts of conflict, unrest, massive long-term protracted displacement, you know, storing up huge problems for the future. And, you know, there were already so many violent exchanges happening between Israel and Iran before October 7th. And of course, the Palestinian situation before October 7th is part of the problem. You know, it wasn't a situation of order for the Palestinians. So I just want to give that context. I think that Iran is a country that does want dramatic change in the regional and the international order. The Iranian sort of government narrative is that things will be much better when the US falls apart or goes into civil war, and Russia and China and Iran are the people in charge. And they, you know, see some of the developments inside the US as validating that viewpoint for them. But, you know, Israel is obviously content with a US-led world, but it has felt that the international community has been failing to deal with the threats that it sees from Iran, including on the nuclear program. And so they have, to some extent, taken matters into their own hands, just with limitations that they don't want to be on their own in some kind of all-out war with Iran. So I think the instability has existed for a long time. It's coming up now in a way that's now obvious to everyone.
Yeah, to sum that up, obviously on October 6, 2023, there was not a great pre-existing order in the Middle East, especially if you're a Palestinian, but there wasn't a great order even if you're Israeli or Iranian. And then the Iranians may say, yeah, we want to order things. We just want an order where Russia and Iran and China rule the roost. You know, one man's order is another woman's disorder. That's all very clear. I do think that we are seeing the reassertion of a pre-October 6 status quo anti-coalition, where the Saudis and Jordanians and Emiratis and maybe even Qataris and Egyptians can work together with Israel and the US. Arthur, what about this question of deterrence capacity? You've worked for the UK government. I have thoughts about deterrence, and I tend to look at it in a kind of game theory or gambling context, but there really hasn't been scholarly work that I find compelling to explain what deterrence is. So if you're Israel, do you actually establish deterrence by showing that you can, you know, have a missile land in an empty field outside a military base in central Iran? Does that accomplish deterrence?
Well, I think to pick up on a point that Jane's made, Iran is already well aware that Israel can do quite a lot of things inside its borders. And, you know, we haven't even mentioned the string of targeted assassinations of very senior figures in the Iranian nuclear program. You know, and some of these assassinations, by definition, will have involved people on the ground in Iran who are clearly working, you know, against that state. So in the sense that deterrence is there, and of course, Israel is also a nuclear armed power. Iran may aspire to that, but they certainly aren't at the moment. One might say that Israel has already quite a clearly defined deterrence sort of posture. I think the issue here is that there's an additional layer of complexity, because we're not really expecting or talking about an interstate war between directly Iran and Israel. And for a long time, there has been a rumbling of what you might call a shadow war, a proxy war. But the idea that somehow that, you know, that the massed armies or other sort of militaries of these two countries would face each other in battle in the way that perhaps we could say we're seeing in Ukraine, that is not on the table. And I still don't think it's on the table now. So I suppose in that context, deterrence is much more complex. Hezbollah can fire rockets into northern Israel, which, of course, they're doing that to some extent on behalf of Iran. Israel, as I've just laid out, can do things inside Iran. But neither of these things present an existential threat to the other country. Where it changes is when Iran perhaps launches 300 missiles and drones. Now, on that occasion, again, it didn't threaten Israel, as we saw. You know, Israel was not substantially affected by the Iranian airstrike. But what we don't know was whether Iran was demonstrating to Israel that it had huge capabilities, but not going sort of giving the full force to them, or whether, in fact, Iran was inadvertently showing Israel that its capabilities were insufficient to breach those air defences.
I want to draw on this before coming to you, Jane, which is that there is a complex set of sign languages and messaging going on here. Yes, I'll show you this. I'm going to show you how strong my missiles are. Oh, look, we can hit this location. Oh, we can defend this. Oh, you can't get away with doing this. We'll do something back. We as analysts, even those with decades and decades of experience, can't understand exactly what is being shown, because you'd need to really have a detailed understanding not only of the technical capabilities of certain missiles and anti-missile and anti-aircraft things, but also the behind-the-scenes communications that each power is having with its allies, because obviously there are Iranian discussions with Russia and America and Israeli discussions with the EU and America and Britain, and they feature into what we're seeing as the tip of the iceberg, which is these missile exchanges as part of a conversation about deterrence and establishing parameters. Jane?
Jason, that fits with exactly the point that I wanted to make about deterrence, which is that deterrence is a form of exerting influence. It's sometimes used to describe a military attack, but the point of it is that you're using military or economic or other means to influence your adversary to decide that it isn't worth trying certain bad things against you because the costs will be too great. But to influence them to make that decision, you need to understand them really well. So, you know, one thing people in the military will say is deterrence involves being able to identify how you can hurt your adversary. And for example, the threat of economic sanctions on Russia did not deter Putin from invading Ukraine, partly because it's been quite hard to find economic sanctions that would really hurt the Kremlin. Another example where we're still looking for the results to come through really is, you know, does a US strike on the Houthis deter them from disrupting shipping in the Red Sea? Or, given their very different worldview, does it actually inadvertently reward them because they can then say, yes, we are at war with the superpower. We're the best bad guys in the Middle East. So the communication is super important. And I think one of the roles of the Sunni Arab states that you've mentioned and also Turkey has been to do a whole lot of message carrying between Iran and Israel and the US to try to understand the red lines, pass warnings and get some kind of indirect conversation going. But there's always a risk of Chinese whispers.
Yes, deterrence is part of a complex conversation which you have with your adversaries to show them where you stand and let them know where they stand. Sometimes those conversations are understood by the other side in a very different way. And yes, Putin was not deterred based on how he understood our weakness, whether it was the response in 2014 to the annexation of Crimea or his watching the tea leaves with the US withdrawal from Afghanistan. However, I want to pivot back to the Israeli decision-making here because we are investigating an Israeli action to make a missile strike. So after the break, why did Israel choose to retaliate? Arthur, it's been interesting to watch the Israeli and American neocon discourse since the Iranian strikes of April the 14th. Essentially, the Israelis came out very clearly and said, we will retaliate at a time of our choosing. And if you've watched the neocon commentariat in DC at places like the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, other Zionist or right-leaning think tanks, Washington Institute, American Enterprise Institute, they've been saying, yes, it's important to reestablish deterrence. Israel has to reestablish deterrence. Then you've heard more right-wing voices in Israel, particularly in the settler movement, like Ben Gvir saying, now is our chance to change the regime in Iran, or now is the chance to eliminate the, you know, Iranian nuclear program, all of which is obviously not true. Now is not the chance to do that because it would cause World War VII. But that discourse has been quite interesting. Set aside from the American center and American left and all of Europe, which is the idea that Israel showed deterrence capacity by its great defense. Biden famously said, Israel should bank the win and just move on. The Iranians said the matter is concluded. Israel showcased that it has vastly superior defense and offense to Iran. That deters Iran in the future. Bank the win, move on. Now, I'm going to show how traditional I am. I think it's a wise idea to listen to one's elders. And if Biden tells you to do something, you should do it. However, we know that the Israelis don't think like that. They have cared particularly increasingly in the last 20 years about showing we can do whatever we want. We're completely independent. You know, Bibi went to Congress and made an alliance with the Republicans in the House of Representatives to showcase he could do whatever he wants. So I can imagine a situation where Bibi just wants to do this to show Biden, look, I can do whatever I want. And obviously that's infantile. And then there is the other aspect whereby Israeli strategic doctrine is always about being on the offense. We can keep our enemies wrong-footed if we show that we're on the offense. You know, Israel before 1967 was, you know, less than 25 kilometers wide at a certain point, and they were afraid of being cut in half, and they've always been like, we have to go on the offense to deter. I am not a military strategist. I think that this is complete bunkum. The deterrence would have been something like saying, great, you know, thank you for those gift of those really easy to shoot down missiles. You know how we're responding, Iran? We are withdrawing from Gaza completely, halting the operation, and saying, you have until May 1st to work with Hamas and the Qataris to give us the hostages back. And if not, we will then respond at a time of our choosing. That would have been a genius move to, you know, to recast Israel in a position of restraint and as the victim. I don't understand why it could be seen as any kind of media win to make a little nothing attack like this.
This is super interesting, Jason, and I'll be interested to hear Arthur's take. But, you know, Netanyahu is now playing in some ways to a pretty narrow constituency inside Israel because he is very beholden for his own coalition survival purposes, you know, to the far right members of his cabinet. Traditionally, he has been full of saber rattling about Iran and has sounded very hawkish, but has actually been pretty cautious about wars until quite recently. Also, it probably never plays well in any country to look like you're being told what to do by the US. And I think he has made some domestic political capital out of standing up to Biden. But again, that's because he's catering to just a part of the population, whereas it seems the mainstream in Israel really values Biden, and Biden has got a lot of political capital where some have thought, you know, maybe him going to the Knesset and setting out a better way forward for the region could be something really worthwhile to do. But there's a kind of dearth of ambition on all sides. I mean, there's also a big question for Iran. It could go one of two ways now. You know, it could say the same things that we need to retaliate and restore deterrence, blah, blah, blah. Or it could see this as an opportunity to buy itself some kudos with the US and with Europe by saying, sure, we're the restrained ones and we'd like you to remember that in the future. It may try to do both things at once on different timescales. Iran likes to hedge its bets, but I think that Iran is still interested in some sort of future diplomacy with the US, and it will be factoring that into its own difficult domestic debates about this.
I think when we're looking at the sort of Israeli motivation, it's worth going back to the first April Israeli strike on the Iranian diplomatic premises in Damascus. And if I say that's what started this, I don't want listeners to misunderstand me sort of suggesting that prior to that there was no beef between Iran and Israel. Clearly, that's not correct. But what I mean is this particular cycle of escalation and tension has a sort of trigger point there. Now, clearly, the striking another country's diplomatic premises is extremely unusual, very highly controversial. The Israelis have claimed, well, it wasn't a diplomatic premise, but I think very few neutral observers would agree with that. And then, so the question is, well, what was Israel trying to achieve in that act? And one answer there may be this point about Netanyahu, and picking up on something that Jane observed, that historically, yes, he's been rather cautious about getting involved in wars, but that seems to have changed now. And I think Netanyahu finds himself in this very strange situation where, as long as the Gaza conflict continues, he is prime minister. But as soon as it looks like it has reached some kind of resolution, and that doesn't mean a satisfactory one, particularly for the people of Gaza, that actually his days as prime minister are basically over. So in a strange way, Netanyahu has this incentive to keep this sort of conflictual situation going. There was a sense that the Israeli campaign in Gaza was hitting the buffers somewhat. The US was becoming increasingly critical of the terrible civilian cost But at the point where Israel strikes an Iranian diplomatic premise, which is akin to obviously striking Iran's sovereign territory, and then Iran responds with a large barrage of missiles and drones, all of a sudden, America and the UK and France and a host of other countries are busily saying in public how strong their support for Israel is. And you're not hearing them talk about the civilian casualties in Gaza, or certainly not for a few days. So I think when we're trying to understand Israel's actions, we have to take into account the fairly sort of cynical and opportunistic behavior of Netanyahu, who is a very unusual prime minister of Israel.
We've talked about this before on this pod. David Patrick Harikos and I talked about it on Monday, which is that the very nature of Netanyahu's neo-populism is he needs to have the war continue to stay in power and to avoid his corruption lawsuit and to stay out of jail. I do think that there is something more than that going on here in terms of why the Israelis have responded. It is egged on by Netanyahu's desire for the war to continue, but there is an Israeli strategic calculus outside of just Netanyahu, because we've seen reports in the New York Times and elsewhere, which is that Benny Gantz and centrist military figures, they wanted to retaliate as well, and they actually wanted to retaliate much sooner without weighing up all the costs and discussing all the options, because of an idea that Israel needs to have strategic unpredictability. It needs to have a kind of knee-jerk, you know, we punch back, our enemies are really afraid of us, that Israeli deterrence is almost Trumpian. You never know what we're going to do. You know, we're the bad boy on the block. I find this very sad because, again, if they had just banked the win, they could have gotten so much cred with Biden, with Sunak, with European populaces. And, of course, the tragedies unfolding in Gaza would be a little bit off the headlines. And Israel could propose something novel, like my idea, we're stopping the Gaza invasion until May 1st, and we need the hostages back by then. But Bibi has said, you know, we're going to go into Rafah right now, you know, in addition to this attack. So it's like, it seems a big FU to the whole world, but with a kind of paper tiger, chicken hawk kind of perspective, which is that the Israelis clearly don't want this to actually get out of control. They want to show, you know, rah, rah, you know, I'm the gorilla beating my chest, but they don't actually want it to spiral out of control completely. Am I missing something, Jane?
Jason, I think that point about wanting the strategic unpredictability and not to be taken for granted is really important here. It also factored in probably to Iran's attack on Israel, because most people were not expecting that. It was widely expected that if Iran was going to move against Israel, it would do what it normally does, which is to activate what it calls its deterrence axis, the non-state actors in the region. And something else that's happened as a result that's quite interesting is that it's temporarily taken some heat off Hezbollah, which has been obviously quite worried that there could be rising Israeli attacks that would be very destructive for Lebanon and would really undercut not just Hezbollah's arms, but its support base in Lebanon. Arthur, I'd love to hear, you know, what you think about that, whether you think Hezbollah is going to get drawn in this round or where that's heading.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jane, because I think if you look at the real threat to Israel, a clear and present danger, it doesn't come from the territory of Iran, it comes from Hezbollah. And as many people have observed, Hezbollah is very well armed. It has not thus far got sort of fully drawn into the ongoing conflict. There's been sort of exchanges of rockets, but nothing on a major scale. And Hezbollah has a huge number, tens of thousands of experienced fighters. So the decision by Iran perhaps not to commit Hezbollah into its retaliation is interesting. But as you say, it's also very interesting that Israel has not, as yet at least, undertaken a sort of major retaliation against Hezbollah. Although it's worth saying there were some drone strikes, I believe, earlier this week, which took out some sort of senior Hezbollah commanders. I think what that tells us is that we've talked about deterrence perhaps from an Israeli perspective, but actually Iran has quite effective deterrence levers on Israel. That Israel, whilst it's preoccupied in Gaza, it obviously has quite serious security concerns in the West Bank as well. Israel really doesn't have the capacity to take on a conflict with Hezbollah on its northern border. And Iran knows that. And I think Iran is able to sort of exercise that lever as well. So we've got this very complex situation where both sides have sort of multiple levers over the other. And it's quite hard to sort of divine could be said to have an upper hand in all of that.
And what I think is critical is it's not like experts are making decisions here. Yes, this is an incredibly complex strategic decision. You know, both sides have bishops and knights and rooks, and they're attacking on a file and a rank, and the one has this defense and the other has this attack. It would be great if there were two chess masters sitting there and playing the game, but that's not what's happening. You know, Netanyahu is making decisions based on his own personal needs and on a whim, and he has to appease complete nutcases like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich. And then on the Iranian side, yes, there are some sane voices, and we're going to return to those when we hear about the diplomacy and things that Iran or Israel could do diplomatically. But the people making the shots are probably some ayatollahs who are more comfortable thinking about the various sayings of Ja'far al-Sadiq in the 8th and 9th centuries and understanding why it was important to overthrow the Abbasid Caliphate than in grasping how modern diplomacy works. So they're not exactly playing, you know, a super genius degree of Garry Kasparov chess here either. Now, I see we have two topics left to cover. One is, how can we use diplomacy to get out of this mess, and what can the sides do? And that's going to be our ordering the disorder. And now, just what do we think is going to happen from here? You know, the forecasting. So, Jane, Iran has two paths it can go down. Tell us, which of these paths might they take, and what do they look like?
My guess is that in the immediate term, Iran is not going to retaliate, although things could change. You know, it's an unpredictable situation. But one indicator is that the Iranian media has been downplaying the attack. It's been at pains to show normal life going on in Isfahan. Interestingly, we've seen that before from Syria, when Syria has been attacked by Israel, that it prefers to downplay it. And if Iran was looking to legitimize retaliation and to get the public rallying around the flag as it went for further escalation, then it would make sense to have a different media narrative. But instead, it's perhaps rather embarrassed by what has happened and is seeking to downplay it. We'll probably see a whole flurry of calls between regional leaders and President Raisi and the Iranian foreign minister, and that will be something to sift for signs as well. Are there then messages being sent on to the US saying, we know that you don't want escalation, maybe there are some things we should try to reach an accommodation on? I think that is most likely. But it is an unpredictable situation. Iranians are also discussing, is this the entirety of the Israeli response, or will more things happen in the coming days? Some of those could be potentially in the cyber domain or things that might be deniable, but really everybody knows. So still very uncertain, but I think it might be an opportunity that Iran takes to gain itself some international leverage.
After the break, can diplomacy order the disorder? Well, Jane and Arthur, it's always darkest before the dawn. I was of the belief that if Israel didn't retaliate at all to the April 14th attacks, it would be in a really good position to initiate some kind of unique diplomacy. For example, Ali Ansari said, oh, Israel should, you know, really put Iran on the back foot and offer a peace treaty, you know, see how they would respond to a, you know, a proposal of full normalization. And it should pull back from Gaza and offer a peace treaty to Saudi Arabia. I love those ideas. But, you know, let's get into the world of the real. We knew that Netanyahu, being who he is, was going to have some retaliation. This was at least smaller than it might have been. No one's been killed. And what kind of diplomacy can emerge from here, Arthur?
Well, I think something I would first observe is that if what we've seen in the last 24 hours is the scale of Israel's retaliation, then you could call it a kind of de-escalation. It seems very limited, the impact on Iran, appears very limited, and within the framework of things that they've put up with in the last 5 years anyway. And I think what we have seen is both sides desperate to avoid a full-scale conflict whilst continuing to push the boundaries. Now, if I was then going to say they're being responsible, I think that's pushing it too far. But I think you can see that both sides are very aware of a need to limit the risks whilst also being risky. So how can we order this? I think, obviously, Iran needs to be engaged, needs to be put sort of back inside the diplomatic tent. We have to remember that, of course, the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, was torn up by President Trump, but there were perfectly reasonable criticisms of that deal, that it only dealt with nuclear issues. It didn't deal with all the other stuff that Iran is doing. And where we are now, I don't think it would be credible to have a diplomatic dialogue with Iran about its nuclear program if you weren't also talking about what is now a kind of encirclement of the Sunni Arab world with Iran's proxies. But to get to that discussion, you've obviously got to get to something in Gaza. And I think we have to sort of wind the clock back to before April the 1st, where actually pressure was being brought to bear on Israel, quite serious US pressure in the light of the killing of the World Kitchen aid workers. Again, one might say, well, hang on, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed. No one seems to have cared about that. Well, unfortunately, that may be the way the world works. Once Western photogenic aid workers die, then people sit up and take notice. Someone, and it has to be the US, has to be ready actually to talk quite firmly to Israel about, well, what is it you're actually trying to achieve here? And what have you achieved? Because at the moment, this is turning into a kind of wanton destruction of a densely populated Arab statelet, at the end of which somebody's got to rebuild it, and they're not going to do that if it's under an Israeli occupation, a military occupation. So I think those are basic questions which were being asked on the first day. You know, Jason, you and I spoke right at the beginning, and they haven't been answered yet. And America has, too slowly in many people's view, but it is very gradually got to the point where it might be willing to push Israel on those questions and force an answer.
That gives the question of diplomacy from the perspective of how America might push Israel. Jane, you alerted me to interesting things happening in Tehran and among various Iranian commentators, where they are thinking that Iran has an opportunity to kind of seize advantage diplomatically. Javed Ghorban Oghli, a former Iranian ambassador to South Africa, wrote, "It seems an opportune moment has arisen for the country's diplomatic apparatus to harvest the fruits of military action against Israel and now negotiate with America from a position of strength." And Sadir Zibilkalam, a professor at the University of Tehran, has expressed a similar viewpoint. He suggests that, quote, "Now, given the disagreements between the U.S. and Israel, Iran has the opportunity to engage in direct negotiations with America for once, so as to advance its interests through diplomatic means rather than ideology." What could Iran do right now to, you know, cast itself as the mature player, work with and triangulate with the Americans relative to their position with Israel?
I've had the chance over recent weeks to have some conversations with Iran-based academics who are quite close to the regime. And it is quite striking that there is this ongoing debate in Iran about whether and how there could be another nuclear deal with the US or a revival of the JCPOA. A concern, I think, is that Iran may in fact be doing quite a lot of the things it's doing, including ramping up its nuclear capabilities, precisely because it expects there to be an opportunity to sit down with the next US president and make a deal, and it considers itself to be piling up bargaining chips. But of course, piling up bargaining chips means also doing things that can trigger a response or can seem escalatory, so it's very difficult. But there's certainly a moment now, at least under the Biden administration, where both sides can surely see that the US has been trying to hold back an escalation in the region, and that this might be a chance to get back to some sort of diplomacy. There was an understanding reached between the US and Iran on various issues before October 7th, but when October 7th happened, the US decided it couldn't keep part of the deal, which was giving Iran access to some of its frozen assets overseas, because it was too toxic in domestic politics in the US for Biden to be seen doing anything that gave the Iranians access to money. He would then, of course, be blamed in a very simplistic way for essentially financing terrorism. So that's been one of the issues as well. But across the partisan aisle in the US, no one's really interested in a regional conflagration or the US getting stuck into a war. So the calculations might be different now if we try to be optimistic.
Okay, so that's a little bit of a perspective on what America could do or what Iran could do. Arthur, what are your thoughts on what the Israelis can do? I've kind of articulated my proposal.
I mean, I think there's can, but we have to be realistic. Israel is currently, you know, governed by a very right-wing coalition, a coalition that includes members of the extreme right, Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, as is well known. And it's not reasonable to expect them to act completely out of the character that has seen them get re-elected time after time. And that's the thing we have to keep remembering, that every time Israel goes to the polls, and it's done so many times in recent years, Netanyahu is the one who's able to stitch together a coalition.
Well, except for when Naftali Bennett actually became prime minister, because people were fed up with Bibi's corruption and you know, nearly 17 years of rule. So there has been an alternative, but it wasn't a left-wing alternative. It was an alternative right-wing.
Yeah, and I suppose it, even then, you know, it didn't prove a sustainable administration. And so in a sense, it doesn't seem to me realistic to look for what one could hope for and argue for, but it doesn't seem realistic to look for a kind of moderate diplomatic approach coming out of the current sort of Israeli political environment. Now, having said all of that, as I mentioned earlier, this war does feel like the final act of Netanyahu's political career. Maybe if there's some kind of a ceasefire, there's some kind of a settlement, we see an Israel that recognizes that actually ignoring the two-state solution or actively opposing it has actually proved disastrous. And October the 7th was the illustration of that. So I think for all the extraordinary challenges that exist around the two-state solution, and again, that's something that Jason, you and I have discussed at other times, it may be that that is basically where Israel has to recognize it needs to go back to.
At a minimum, Israel will need some hostages to be released to make any movement, I think, in terms of being able to show something to the domestic public. So that is something where, of course, there's been a lot of diplomacy around hostages in exchange for prisoners and a ceasefire, but it's becoming more and more urgent. There's a risk Hamas might feel emboldened by some of the Iranian actions recently. Here, Egypt and other Arab countries could play a role in trying to convince Hamas to show some flexibility on the hostage releases. I think, Arthur, you're completely right that people are not going to change their behaviour dramatically, and I just cannot imagine Bibi Netanyahu now saying that he's for a two-state solution. And if he did, I don't think anyone would believe it. But since he won't be there forever, again, it is a time where the rest of the world needs to be saying quite clearly, this is going to happen, and it's no longer up to Israel to decide whether there's going to be a Palestinian state. It's up to Israel to work out with the Palestinians the issues like the borders and the relations between them, but not the question of statehood. And it's possible in the next few months we might see a group of European countries, including Spain, Ireland, Norway and others, moving to recognise a Palestinian state, which is symbolic more than anything else, but would be designed to send exactly that message. If the UK or US was to do it, that would really be a change.
Well, it's not happening in the U.S. We obviously know about the U.N. vote where the U.S. was the only one to vote against symbolically giving a Palestinian pseudo-state the ability to function at the U.N. as a state. But okay, I'm not sure we've ordered the disorder here. We've thrown out lots of different reasons that things are not going to happen and can't work. I think it is important to take the Israeli right seriously. they may have certain theories about deterrence, and they feel that Iran as a evil regime that has, you know, tortured its own people and killed lots of people abroad and you know, supports various proxies, needs to be deterred. And I can understand that. I don't think this is the right way, because it needs to be nuanced with, you know, diplomatic movements on the Palestinian track. But this very minimal attack back may have the potential to escalate to de-escalate, for lack of a better term, which is that by not killing anyone, by doing something that, as Jane had pointed out, that they've already been doing prior to April 1st, they haven't expanded by breaking a new red line. And who knows, maybe the disorder will be ordered, because people don't seem to want a regional war. And the Israelis don't want it, and the Iranians don't want it, and the Americans certainly don't want it. So, yeah, stay tuned, watch this space, and hopefully we'll be able to not have bonus episodes, because not needing to have a bonus episode will mean that there hasn't been more escalations. Hope everyone has a great weekend. And that's it for this really action-packed week. If you too want to help order the disorder, you can tap follow right now. You'll be notified when every episode launches. And yep, we're on social media too. Just search Disorder Show. Finally, if you want to learn more about the Israeli retaliation against Iran, which just happened in the early morning hours of today, April the 19th, please follow the links in the show notes. And if you're interested in more background on these kind of topics, subscribe to our Substack, or to Arthur's lovely Substack that we're going to put a link to in the show notes, or check out his really interesting podcast, Behind the Lines. It's completely free, as is my own Substack. All the links are in, you guessed it, the show notes. For this episode, we have a pinch-hitting producer. His name is James Hodson. As always, our executive producer is Neil Fern. Thanks for listening. And I hope your week is more ordered than the Middle East.